Yet we have merely been playing with it and have never seriously studied it as we have the physical forces. Someday people will learn that material things do not bring happiness and are of little use in making men and women creative and powerful. Then the scientists of the world will turn their laboratories over to the study of God and prayer and the spiritual forces which as yet have hardly been scratched. When this day comes, the world will see more advancement in one generation than it has seen in the past four. Gandhi's epoch has extended, with the beautiful precision of cosmic timing, into a century already desolated and devastated by two world wars. A divine handwriting appears on the granite wall of his life, a warning against the further shedding of blood among brothers. Mahatma Gandhi visited my high school with yoga training at Ranchi. He graciously wrote the above lines in the Ranchi guest book. The translation is, "This institution has deeply impressed my mind. I cherish high hopes that this school will encourage the further practical use of the spinning wheel." Signed, Mohandas Gandhi. September 17, 1925. A national flag for India was designed in 1921 by Gandhi. The stripes are saffron, white and green. The charka, spinning wheel, in the center is dark blue. The charka symbolizes energy, he wrote, and reminds us that during the past eras of prosperity in India's history, hand spinning and other domestic crafts were prominent. Chapter 45. The Bengali joy permeated mother. "Sir, please do not leave India without a glimpse of Nirmala Devi. Her sanctity is intense, she is known far and wide as Anandamoyi Ma, joy permeated mother. My niece, Amma Eo Bose, gazed at me earnestly. Of course. I want very much to see the woman saint." I added, "I have read of her advanced state of God realization. A little article about her appeared years ago in East West. I have met her," Amma Eo went on. "She recently visited my own little town of Jamshedpur. At the entreaty of a disciple, Anandamoyi Ma went to the home of a dying man. She stood by his bedside, as her hand touched his forehead, his death rattle ceased. The disease vanished at once, to the man's glad astonishment, he was well. A few days later I heard that the blissful mother was staying at the home of a disciple in the Bhawanipur section of Calcutta. Mr. Wright and I set out immediately from my father's Calcutta home. As the Ford neared the Bhawanipur house, my companion and I observed an unusual street scene. Anandamoyi Ma was standing in an open-topped automobile, blessing a throng of about 100 disciples. She was evidently on the point of departure. Mr. Wright parked the Ford some distance away, and accompanied me on foot toward the quiet assemblage. The woman saint glanced in our direction, she alighted from her car and walked toward us. 'Father, you have come.' With these fervent words she put her arm around my neck and her head on my shoulder. Mr. Wright, to whom I had just remarked that I did not know the saint, was hugely enjoying this extraordinary demonstration of welcome. The eyes of the 100 chelas were also fixed with some surprise on the affectionate tableau. I had instantly seen that the saint was in a high state of samadhi. Utterly oblivious to her outward garb as a woman, she knew herself as the changeless soul. From that plane she was joyously greeting another devotee of God. She led me by the hand into her automobile. 'Anandamoyi Ma, I am delaying your journey.' I protested. 'Father, I am meeting you for the first time in this life, after ages,' she said. 'Please do not leave yet.' We sat together in the rear seats of the car. The blissful mother soon entered the immobile ecstatic state. Her beautiful eyes glanced heavenward and, half opened, became stilled, gazing into the near-far inner Elysium. The disciples chanted gently, 'Victory to Mother Divine.' I had found many men of God realization in India, but never before had I met such an exalted woman saint. Her gentle face was burnished with the ineffable joy that had given her the name of Blissful Mother. Long black dresses lay loosely behind her unveiled head. A red dot of sandalwood paste on her forehead symbolized the spiritual eye, ever open within her. Tiny face, tiny hands, tiny feet, a contrast to her spiritual magnitude. I put some questions to a nearby woman, Keela, while Anandamoyi Ma remained entranced. The blissful mother travels widely in India. In many parts she has hundreds of disciples, the Keela told me. Her courageous efforts have brought about many desirable social reforms. Although a Brahmin, the saint recognizes no caste distinctions. A group of us always travel with her, looking after her comforts. We have to mother her, she takes no notice of her body. If no one gave her food, she would not eat, or make any inquiries. Even when meals are placed before her, she does not touch them. To prevent her disappearance from this world, we disciples feed her with our own hands. For days together she often stays in the divine trance, scarcely breathing, her eyes unwinking. One of her chief disciples is her husband. Many years ago, soon after their marriage, he took the vow of silence. The Keela pointed to a broad-shouldered, fine-featured man with long hair and hoary beard. He was standing quietly in the midst of the gathering, his hands folded in a disciple's reverential attitude. Refreshed by her dip in the infinite, Ananda Moyima was now focusing her consciousness on the material world. Father, please tell me where you stay. Her voice was clear and melodious. At present, in Calcutta or Anchai, but soon I shall be returning to America.
America?
Yes. An Indian woman saint would be sincerely appreciated by spiritual seekers.
Would you like to go?
If Father can take me, I will go. This reply caused her nearby disciples to start an alarm. 20 or more of us always travel with the blissful mother, one of them told me firmly. We could not live without her. Wherever she goes, we must go. Reluctantly I abandoned the plan, as possessing an impractical feature of spontaneous enlargement. Please come at least to Ranchi, with your disciples, I said on taking leave of the saint. As a divine child yourself, you will enjoy the little ones in my school. Whenever Father takes me, I will gladly go. A short time later the Ranchi Vidyalaya was in gala array for the saint's promised visit. The youngsters looked forward to any day of festivity, no lessons, hours of music, and a feast for the climax. Victory. Ananda Moyima, KJI. This reiterated chant from scores of enthusiastic little throats greeted the saint's party as it entered the school gates. Showers of marigolds, tinkle of cymbals, lusty blowing of conch shells and beat of the mridanga drum. The blissful mother wandered smilingly over the sunny Vidyalaya grounds, ever carrying within her the portable paradise. It is beautiful here, Ananda Moyima said graciously as I led her into the main building. She seated herself with a childlike smile by my side. The closest of dear friends, she made one feel, yet an aura of remoteness was ever around her, the paradoxical isolation of omnipresence. Please tell me something of your life. Father knows all about it, why repeat it? She evidently felt that the factual history of one short incarnation was beneath notice. I laughed, gently repeating my question. Father, there is little to tell. She spread her graceful hands in a deprecatory gesture. My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on this earth, Father, I was the same. As a little girl, I was the same. I grew into womanhood, but still I was the same. When the family in which I had been born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. And when, passion drunk, my husband came to me and murmured endearing words, lightly touching my body, he received a violent shock, as if struck by lightning, for even then I was the same. My husband knelt before me, folded his hands, and implored my pardon. Mother, he said, because I have desecrated your bodily temple by touching it with the thought of lust, not knowing that within it dwelt not my wife but the Divine Mother, I take this solemn vow, I shall be your disciple, a celibate follower, ever caring for you in silence as a servant, never speaking to anyone again as long as I live. May I thus atone for the sin I have today committed against you, my Guru. Even when I quietly accepted this proposal of my husband's, I was the same. And, Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Ever afterward, though the dance of creation change around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same. Ananda Moyima sank into a deep meditative state.
Her form was statue still, she had fled to her ever-calling kingdom. The dark pools of her eyes appeared lifeless and glassy. This expression is often present when saints remove their consciousness from the physical body, which is then hardly more than a piece of soulless clay. We sat together for an hour in the ecstatic trance. She returned to this world with a gay little laugh. "Please, Ananda Moyi Ma," I said, "come with me to the garden. Mr. Wright will take some pictures."
"Of course, Father. Your will is my will."
Her glorious eyes retained the unchanging divine luster as she posed for many photographs. Time for the feast. Ananda Moyi Ma squatted on her blanket seat, a disciple at her elbow to feed her. Like an infant, the saint obediently swallowed the food after the Kila had brought it to her lips. It was plain that the blissful mother did not recognize any difference between curries and sweetmeats. As dusk approached, the saint left with her party amidst a shower of rose petals, her hands raised in blessing on the little lads. Their faces shone with the affection she had effortlessly awakened. "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength," Christ has proclaimed, "this is the first commandment." Casting aside every inferior attachment, Ananda Moyi Ma offers her soul allegiance to the Lord. Not by the hair-splitting distinctions of scholars but by the sure logic of faith, the childlike saint has solved the only problem in human life: establishment of unity with God. Man has forgotten this stark simplicity, now befogged by a million issues. Refusing a monotheistic love to God, the nations disguise their infidelity by punctilious respect before the outward shrines of charity. These humanitarian gestures are virtuous, because for a moment they divert man's attention from himself, but they do not free him from his single responsibility in life, referred to by Jesus as the first commandment. The uplifting obligation to love God is assumed with man's first breath of an air freely bestowed by his only benefactor. On one other occasion after her Anshai visit I had opportunity to see Ananda Moyi Ma. She stood among her disciples some months later on the Serampore station platform, waiting for the train. "Father, I am going to the Himalayas," she told me. "Generous disciples have built me a hermitage in Dehradun." As she boarded the train, I marveled to see that whether amidst a crowd, on a train, feasting, or sitting in silence, her eyes never looked away from God. Within me I still hear her voice, an echo of measureless sweetness: "Behold, now and always one with the Eternal, I am ever the same." Chapter 46. The Woman Yogi Who Never Eats. "Sir, whither are we bound this morning?"
"Mr. Wright." He was driving the Ford. He took his eyes off the road long enough to gaze at me with a questioning twinkle. From day to day he seldom knew what part of Bengal he would be discovering next.
"God willing," I replied devoutly, "we are on our way to see an eighth wonder of the world, a woman saint whose diet is thin air. Repetition of wonders after three's Newman." But Mr. Wright laughed eagerly just the same. He even accelerated the speed of the car. More extraordinary grist for his travel diary. Not one of an average tourist, that. The Ranchi school had just been left behind us, we had risen before the sun. Besides my secretary and myself, three Bengali friends were in the party. We drank in the exhilarating air, the natural wine of the morning. Our driver guided the car warily among the early peasants and the two-wheeled carts, slowly drawn by yoked, hump-shouldered bullocks, inclined to dispute the road with a honking interloper.
"Sir, we would like to know more of the fasting saint."
"Her name is Giribala," I informed my companions. "I first heard about her years ago from a scholarly gentleman, Stiti Lal Nandi. He often came to the Guppa Road home to tutor my brother Baisho." "I know Giribala well," Stiti Babu told me. "She employs a certain yoga technique which enables her to live without eating. I was her close neighbor in the Wab Ganj near Akapa. I made it a point to watch her closely. Never did I find evidence that she was taking either food or drink." My interest finally mounted so high that I approached the Maharaja of Burdwan and asked him to conduct an investigation. Astounded at the story, he invited her to his palace.
She agreed to a test and lived for 2 months locked up in a small section of his home. Later she returned for a palace visit of 20 days, and then for a third test of 15 days. The Maharaja himself told me that these three rigorous scrutinies had convinced him beyond doubt of her non-eating state. This story of Stiti Babu's has remained in my mind for over 25 years, I concluded. Sometimes in America I wondered if the river of time would not swallow the yogini before I could meet her. She must be quite aged now. I do not even know where, or if, she lives. But in a few hours we shall reach Purulia. Her brother has a home there. By 10:30 our little group was conversing with the brother, Lambodade, a lawyer of Purulia. Yes, my sister is living. She sometimes stays with me here. But at present she is at our family home in Bhut. Lambodabhu glanced doubtfully at the Ford. I hardly think, Swamiji, that any automobile has ever penetrated into the interior as far as Bhut. It might be best if you all resign yourselves to the ancient jolt of the bullock cart. As one voice our party pledged loyalty to the pride of Detroit. The Ford comes from America, I told the lawyer. It would be a shame to deprive it of an opportunity to get acquainted with the heart of Bengal. May Ganesha inverted exclamation mark go with you, Lambodababu said, laughing. He added courteously, if you ever get there, I am sure Giri Bale will be glad to see you. She is approaching her 70s, but continues in excellent health. Please tell me, sir, if it is absolutely true that she eats nothing? I looked directly into his eyes. Those telltale windows of the mind. It is true. His gaze was open and honorable. In more than 5 decades I have never seen her eat a morsel. If the world suddenly came to an end, I could not be more astonished than by the sight of my sisters taking food. We chuckled together over the improbability of these two cosmic events. Giri Bala has never sought an inaccessible solitude for her yoga practices, Lambodababu went on. She has lived her entire life surrounded by her family and friends. They are all well accustomed now to her strange state. Not one of them who would not be stupefied if Giri Bala suddenly decided to eat anything. Sister is naturally retiring, as befits a Hindu widow, but our little circle in Purulia and in Bhut all know that she is literally an exceptional woman. The brother's sincerity was manifest. Our little party thanked him warmly and set out toward Bhut. We stopped at a street shop for curry and lukis, attracting a swarm of urchins who gathered round to watch Mr. Wright eating with his fingers in the simple Hindu manner. Hearty appetites caused us to fortify ourselves against an afternoon which, unknown at the moment, was to prove fairly laborious. Our way now led east through sun-baked rice fields into the Burdwan section of Bengal. On through roads lined with dense vegetation, the songs of the mainas and the striped-throated bulbuls streamed out from trees with huge, umbrella-like branches. A bullock cart now and then. The rinny, rinny, manju, manju squeak of its axle and iron-shod wooden wheels contrasting sharply in mind with the swish, swish of auto tires over the aristocratic asphalt of the cities. Dick, halt. My sudden request brought a jolting protest from the Ford. That overburdened mango tree is fairly shouting an invitation. The five of us dashed like children to the mango-strewn earth. The tree had benevolently shed its fruits as they had ripened. Full many a mango is born to lie unseen, I paraphrased, and waste its sweetness on the stony ground. Nothing like this in America, Swamiji, eh? Laughed Sailesh Mazumdar, one of my Bengali students. No. I admitted, covered with mango juice and contentment. How I have missed this fruit in the West. A Hindu's heaven without mangoes is inconceivable. I picked up a rock and downed a proud beauty hidden on the highest limb. Dick, I asked between bites of ambrosia, warm with the tropical sun, are all the cameras in the car? Yes, sir, in the baggage compartment. If Giri Bala proves to be a true saint, I want to write about her in the West. A Hindu yogini with such inspiring powers should not live and die unknown like most of these mangoes. Half an hour later I was still strolling in the sylvan peace. Sir, Mr. Wright remarked, We should reach Kiribati before the sun sets, to have enough light for photographs. He added with a grin, the Westerners are a skeptical lot, we can't expect them to believe in the lady without any pictures. This bit of wisdom was indisputable. I turned my back on temptation and re-entered the car.
You are right, Dick, I sighed as we sped along. I sacrifice the mango paradise on the altar of Western realism. Photographs we must have.
The road became more and more sickly, wrinkles of ruts, boils of hardened clay, the sad infirmities of old age. Our group dismounted occasionally to allow Mr. Wright to more easily maneuver the Ford, which the four of us pushed from behind. Lambadababu spoke truly, Sailesh acknowledged. The car is not carrying us, we are carrying the car. Our climb in, climb out auto tedium was beguiled ever and anon by the appearance of a village, each one a scene of quaint simplicity. Our way twisted and turned through groves of palms among ancient, unspoiled villages nestling in the forest shade, Mr. Wright has recorded in his travel diary, under date of May 5, 1936. Very fascinating are these clusters of thatched mud huts, decorated with one of the names of God on the door, many small, naked children innocently playing about, pausing to stare or run wildly from this big, black, bullockless carriage tearing madly through their village. The women merely peep from the shadows, while the men lazily loll beneath the trees along the roadside, curious beneath their nonchalance. In one place, all the villagers were gaily bailing in the large tank, in their garments, changing by draping dry cloths around their bodies, dropping the wet ones. Women bearing water to their homes, in huge brass jars. The road led us a merry chase over mountain ridge, we bounced and tossed, dipped into small streams, detoured around an unfinished causeway, slithered across dry, sandy river beds and finally, about 5 p.m., we were close to our destination, Gud. This minute village in the interior of Bangura district, hidden in the protection of dense foliage, is unapproachable by travelers during the rainy season, when the streams are raging torrents and the roads serpent-like spit the mud venom. Asking for a guide among a group of worshippers on their way home from a temple prayer, out in the lonely field, we were besieged by a dozen scantily clad lads who clambered on the sides of the car, eager to conduct us to Kiribati. The road led toward a grove of date palms sheltering a group of mud huts, but before we had reached it, the Ford was momentarily tipped at a dangerous angle, tossed up and dropped down. The narrow trail led around trees and tank, over ridges, into holes and deep ruts. The car became anchored on a clump of bushes, then grounded on a hillock, requiring a lift of earth clods. On we proceeded, slowly and carefully. Suddenly the way was stopped by a mass of brush in the middle of the cart track, necessitating a detour down a precipitous ledge into a dry tank, rescue from which demanded some scraping, adzing, and shoveling. Again and again, the road seemed impassable, but the pilgrimage must go on. Obliging lads fetched spades and demolished the obstacles shades of Ganesh, while hundreds of children and parents stared. Soon we were threading our way along the two ruts of antiquity, women gazing wide-eyed from their hut doors, men trailing alongside and behind us, children scampering to swell the procession. Ours was perhaps the first auto to traverse these roads. The bullock cart union must be omnipotent here. What a sensation we created, a group piloted by an American and pioneering in a snorting car right into the hamlet fastness, invading the ancient privacy and sanctity. Halting by a narrow lane, we found ourselves within 100 feet of Kiribati's ancestral home. We felt the thrill of fulfillment after the long road struggle crowned by a rough finish. We approached a large, two-storied building of brick and plaster, dominating the surrounding adobe huts. The house was under the process of repair, for around it was the characteristically tropical framework of bamboos. With feverish anticipation and suppressed rejoicing, we stood before the open doors of the one blessed by the Lord's hungerless touch. Constantly agape were the villagers, young and old, bare and dressed, women aloof somewhat but inquisitive too, men and boys unabashedly at our heels as they gazed on this unprecedented spectacle. Soon a short figure came into view in the doorway, Kiribati, She was swathed in a cloth of dull, goldish silk, in typically Indian fashion. She drew forward modestly and hesitatingly, peering slightly from beneath the upper fold of her swadeshi cloth. Her eyes glistened like smoldering embers in the shadow of her headpiece. We were enamored by a most benevolent and kindly face, a face of realization and understanding, free from the taint of earthly attachment. Meekly she approached and silently assented to our snapping a number of pictures with our still and movie cameras. Patiently and shyly she endured our photo techniques of posture adjustment and light arrangement. Finally we had recorded for posterity many photographs of the only woman in the world who is known to have lived without food or drink for over 50 years. Therese Newman, of course, has fasted since 1923. Most motherly was Giribala's expression as she stood before us, completely covered in the loose flowing cloth, nothing of her body visible but her face with its downcast eyes, her hands, and her tiny feet. A face of rare peace and innocent poise, a wide, childlike, quivering lip, a feminine nose, narrow, sparkling eyes, and a wistful smile. Mr. Wright's impression of Giribala was shared by myself. Spirituality enfolded her like a gently shining veil. She pronamed before me in the customary gesture of greeting from a householder to a monk. Her simple charm and quiet smile gave us a welcome beyond that of honeyed oratory. Forgotten was our difficult, dusty trip. The little saint seated herself cross-legged on the veranda. Though bearing the scars of age, she was not emaciated. Her olive-colored skin had remained clear and healthy in tone. Mother, I said in Bengali, for over 25 years I have thought eagerly of this very pilgrimage. I heard about your sacred life from Stitilal Nandi Babu. She nodded in acknowledgement. Yes, my good neighbor in Nawab Ganj. During those years I have crossed the oceans, but I never forgot my early plan to someday see you. The sublime drama that you are here playing so inconspicuously should be blazoned before a world that has long forgotten the inner food divine. The saint lifted her eyes for a minute, smiling with serene interest. Baba, honored father, knows best, she answered meekly. I was happy that she had taken no offense. One never knows how great yogis or yoginis will react to the thought of publicity. They shun it, as a rule, wishing to pursue in silence the profound soul research. An inner sanction comes to them when the proper time arrives to display their lives openly for the benefit of seeking minds. Mother, I went on, please forgive me, then, for a woman yogi who never eats, burdening you with many questions. Kindly answer only those that please you, I shall understand your silence, also. She spread her hands in a gracious gesture. I am glad to reply. Insofar as an insignificant person like myself can give satisfactory answers. Oh, no, not insignificant. I protested sincerely. You are a great soul. I am the humble servant of all. She added quaintly, I love to cook and feed people. A strange pastime, I thought, for a non-eating saint. Tell me, mother, from your own lips do you live without food? That is true. She was silent for a few moments. Her next remark showed that she had been struggling with mental arithmetic. From the age of 12 years 4 months down to my present age of 68, a period of over 56 years, I have not eaten food or taken liquids. Are you never tempted to eat? If I felt a craving for food, I would have to eat. Simply yet eagerly she stated this axiomatic truth, one known too well by a world revolving around 3 meals a day. But you do eat something. My tone held a note of remonstrance. Of course. She smiled in swift understanding. Your nourishment derives from the finer energies of the air and sunlight, and from the cosmic power which recharges your body through the medulla oblongata. Baba knows. Again she acquiesced, her manner soothing and unemphatic. Mother, please tell me about your early life. It holds a deep interest for all of India, and even for our brothers and sisters beyond the seas. Giribala put aside her habitual reserve, relaxing into a conversational mood. So be it. Her voice was low and firm. I was born in these forest regions. My childhood was unremarkable save that I was possessed by an insatiable appetite. I had been betrothed in early years. Child, my mother often warned me, try to control your greed.